Off the Ball, GAA.
The story out there was that they were the tough team, Tipperary. They were the team all the steel, because we were kind of the aristocrats, the team with all the skill.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Hey there, it's Owen here, and you're welcome back to Diverted, a 10-part original series for Off the Ball. In every episode of this series, we go to a different country in Latin America, and this week, we're going to Bolivia. We'll be visiting a small town for a festival, where the local tribes meet up and fight one another in order to spill blood and make a decent sacrifice to their gods. That's coming your way in just a few minutes. Before that, though, we're getting you back to the hitchhiking journey through Patagonia. Last week's hitchhiking diary ended on what some might call a cliffhanger. So, if you haven't listened to episode 2, what's coming up is what some might call a spoiler. But if you just want this episode and you're listening to the series for the first time, just a heads up that these episodes happen on two separate timelines. So, Bolivia, it's coming up in a sec, after we bring you up to speed on Patagonia. There's going to be some bad language in this episode, but if you like what you hear, a 5-star rating would be most welcome. Cheers.
Yeah, I think today was just a series of very, very bad decisions.
I've been hitchhiking through Patagonia for a day and a half. Or maybe I should say I've been trying to hitchhike. I've been on the road today for 5 hours. And in that time, I've travelled a grand total of 48 kilometres. If you crunch those numbers, you'll realise that I might just be the worst hitchhiker on the planet, and I am currently standing in the middle of nowhere. Ezkel is a town 116 kilometres down the road, and I want to get there tonight. This section of Route 40 seems to regard existence as fanciful, and I even begin to miss the rejection. I begin the 10-kilometre walk back to Epigen, because if I'm going to be stuck out here when the sun goes down, I'd rather be in a place with at least some phone reception, and maybe a chance at finding a hotel. A small white van appears, driving south. Butterflies. But then I see the van is full. It drives past. That familiar, crushing feeling, just manifesting itself deep within my soul. But after about 200 metres, the van stops and pulls in. A side door gets slid open. And it's funny how my cardiovascular ceiling goes to a whole new level. I sprint, and yeah, the van is full, but there are two girls and a dog squeezed into the back. There are no seats, but it appears that they're happy enough to squeeze one more in. Now, I didn't think that this would be the moment I realised what true joy is in my life, but stuffing myself into a crappy little white van with strangers is clearly what real happiness feels like right now. It's joy bundled in relief. There's an Argentinian man driving, and there are three Uruguayan women and a Uruguayan dog. The dog's name is Murray, and he is a very good boy. Murray and his friends are going all the way to Ezkel, and they've come from a music festival in Neuquén, 9 hours north of here. And they ask me about Irish music.
Sinead O'Connor, the Cranberries.
Sinead O'Connor, claro, the Fox.
Yeah, you don't need to hear me try to explain Fairy Tale of New York in my crap Spanish. We drive on for an hour and a quarter, and the nothingness in the landscape suddenly changes.
Wow, holy shit.
Oh shit indeed. Ezkel is beautiful. There's a police checkpoint going into the city. This vehicle has three humans and a dog more than it should be carrying. The van stops. Clicks into reverse. Yep, that's the sound of a wing mirror becoming acquainted with a road sign. In typical Latin American style, we take a be grand approach. We get out to start walking towards the checkpoint.
Y no, ahora no.
Ah, los trajo.
Sí.
Del Bolsón.
Sí.
I'm pretty sure the policeman who's having a conversation with one of my new friends here knows exactly what's going on.
but we walk through the checkpoint and meet back up with the van. It's official. I've made it to civilization. To a town with food and beds and a safe haven from Route 40 for the night.
Amigos, aquí es Centro.
Centro?
Yes, perfecto.
No estoy seguro cómo se dice en español, pero you saved me today. Gracias, gracias.
Buen viaje.
Hasta luego. Hasta luego. Buen viaje.
I get to a hostel, post a couple of Instagram stories, and the reaction from my friends fills me with great hope and optimism, including this voice note from Paul.
Well, lad, how's the hitchhiking going? I'm keenly following it. It looks unbelievable, but also unbelievably shite. Yeah, just checking in on you, see you still alive and not bushwhacked somewhere.
I now have 13 days before my flight from Ushuaia, which means roughly 2,000 more kilometres of hitchhiking along the fastest route. Considering I've only managed 284 kilometres in two full days, my current rate of progress will not get me there on time. Therefore, it might be a little bit stupid to be considering a massive detour. I've noticed some of these flags bearing the Welsh dragon here in Ezkel. Of course, I should keep moving south to get to the bottom of the continent as quickly as I possibly can, but because I'm a terrible decision maker, when I wake up tomorrow morning, I'm actually going to try and hitchhike east, and I'm going to try and visit some of these famous Welsh towns in Patagonia. So the new plan is to go cross-country before continuing south. I want to go from the Andes to the Atlantic. I guess what I'm trying to do here is to rewrite the famous Dwight Schrute quote. Whenever I'm about to do something, I think, would an idiot do that? And if they would, I do that thing. Two months later.
Yes.
I'm in Bolivia, and it's festival season.
How long is this bus?
I think 3 hours.
We're hoping that this minibus takes us up the mountains to a small town called Macha. Because up in Macha, there's a festival called Tinku. Now, Tinku is not a festival of music or arts or crafts. Tinku is a fighting festival. It is the Glastonbury of people beating the shit out of each other in the name of the gods.
This is your last chance to do a U-turn, lads.
Tinku is not an event for tourists. But there are 9 of us en route. 4 Irish, 3 English, and 2 Scots. It's like the beginning of a terrible joke.
This is the situation on Google Maps. There's no roads getting down to this place. I think we should go down here somewhere.
There's only one hotel I can find online, and it's in a nearby town called Pacuata.
This should be it.
Hola. ¿Es el hotel?
That would be a yes.
The hotel is massive, but completely empty. Like a Stephen King creation. There appears to be a sauna, and there's certainly a karaoke room, which appears to have a fully equipped bar.
Owen es mi nombre. A-O-E-N-A. Estuve conversación al WhatsApp contigo.
Who ever stays here is unclear, because this is supposed to be one of the biggest weekends of the year, and we're the only guests. And the small town of Pucuata in general is subdued. It doesn't feel like anything resembling a celebration. So we go to Macha, host of the main event. Now here's the thing, we've done our research on this. We've read a lot online and we know what's supposed to happen. Every May in this small town, high in the Andes, all of the tribes of farmers gather in the main square of the town. They proceed to drink a lot and then they fight. They used to fight to the death, but we're pretty sure that's not what's supposed to happen anymore. Now, they fight merely to spill blood, because blood will satisfy Mother Earth. Or Pachamama, as she's known in this neck of the woods. And the more blood Pachamama drinks, the more likely she is to grant your community a good harvest for the season ahead. Here's Daniel, a tour guide I met in La Paz.
You need to know that Pachamama is a general idea all around South America, you know, and the general idea is Mother Nature, you know. So, of course, if you believe in Mother Nature as indigenous, you know, we know that as long as she has a good life, we will have a good life too, you know. And to make her happy, we have all these different offerings, you know, all these different rituals. And, yeah, I think Tinku is the most extreme one, you know, is the most extreme. Here, Aymara people believe a lot in energy. If we understand our culture, then combat is not to show who's best, okay. You know, it's not to show who's stronger. Actually, combat is also a share of energy, you know, and this is happening in the ritual of Tinku, you know. So, yeah, it's nothing just to say, yeah, I'm bigger than you, I'm stronger than you, I'm better than you. No, it's just another way of sharing. You know, it's a different way of sharing too.
Macha has a population of a few hundred people and sits around 3.5 kilometers above sea level. There's a main square in the middle of the town and dirt roads lined with small brick buildings moving off in every direction. At the southwest corner of the square, the tower of the church looks over the whole town. And when we arrive, there is a clear lack of fighting.
I haven't got to grips with what's the story.
It's just locals selling food at stalls and lots of people staring at us.
They want you to have your chicken off the barbecue and get a dig in the face while you're ordering it.
I've read stuff about outsiders not being exempt from the fighting, so I do wonder if people are staring at me to size me up for a potential sacrifice to Pachamama, or if it's just my big Irish head that's to blame. Then the music starts. This melody is going to be repeated for the next 48 hours. It's played on a siki, which is a traditional Andean panpipe.
It's a pretty haunting soundtrack, and it isn't the last thing I hear before I die.
It starts to become clear that tonight is something of an opening ceremony. It's for music, it's for dance, and it's for drinking. The dance has a sort of warlike rhythm. They march for a bit, then they dance in a circle for a bit. And when they dance, they get into this sort of crouching stance, bent over at the waist. Then you've got the arms and the hands waving towards the ground that they're stomping on, and they jump from one foot to the other. As for the drinking part, every house is selling 6-packs of kilnets.
When you get a drink, you're also meant to like pour a couple of sips on the ground.
A strong fermented alcohol called chicha is also being passed around. Paul is the tallest member of our group, and he's getting most of the looks.
Paul has turned out to be a bit of a magnet for the tough guys around here.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There was a guy playing a ukulele, and he stopped. And no, not the guy with the whip. Oh, he came up and took his can of kilnets out of his hand, threw it on the ground, and started playing his ukulele again.
We hear rumours of a fight having broken out in a side street.
The whole place to clear out. Like, I mean, they love their ritualistic dancing, but they love fighting way more. Yeah. As soon as the fight started, I was like, where's all the people watching the dancing now?
But a friendly local man named Mickey gives us the lowdown.
What's your name? What's your name?
My name is Owen. Owen.
Owen.
E tu?
Mickey.
Mickey,
un gusto, mi amigo.
Mucho gusto, amigo.
Fighting is not supposed to be happening until tomorrow. Then, every adult in the town is likely to be challenged to fight at least once during the day, he says. It doesn't matter where you're from. Stick together and come early, is what he suggests.
Salud, Mickey.
Bienvenidos. Welcome to Macha.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much for visiting my city.
No.
My
country. Muchas gracias para los bienvenidos.
Sí, sí, sí. 7:30 a.m.
There's the police and the bus loads.
A local man with a minibus is driving us back to Macha.
I'm getting a bit nervous now. It is a bit like Glastonbury, isn't it?
Aye.
I think what scares me the most about this is no one looks scared.
Yeah, well, and they also look very prepared.
Yeah. Aye, boys, we're here. Quite busy for 8 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. For South America in particular, they don't tend to do AMs here.
No.
Only for a big fucking scrap.
It appears that most of the people around the town right now have been drinking right the way through tonight.
Muy buenos días, hermano.
Buenos días, ¿cómo estás?
Estamos aquí, haciendo que
Ay, David, loco, man, ¿de dónde ustedes? ¿De dónde son ustedes?
¿De dónde?
Del lugar, ¿de dónde son ustedes?
Irlanda.
Holanda.
Irlanda.
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 That's how drunk people are right now. Yeah. What is going to be like from 4 p.m?
I meet a guy called Remberto on one of the side streets.
It's my first time and I'm here to enjoy. Yeah.
What have you heard about this festival?
That they fight each other. And some people in the past, they used to die. So this caught me the attention, so I come here to see. Nowadays, of course, they don't die. But I was reading a lot, and they say that probably they kill each other once the festivity is done. The next day, continue the festivity, and they kill each other. So,
you say that they choose to die?
Some of them. Mm-hmm. Some of them, yes, they choose. They decide, you know. Because for them it's not something bad. If somebody die, for the whole community is like an offering for Pachamama to say thank you for what they have in life, the products, all this stuff.
So a death is more significant than merely spilling blood, in their opinion?
Wow, yeah, I can say that as well.
This is a scaremongering. Odds are someone's going to die today.
We have in the area of Potosí, we have a lot of communities from the top, from the down, and there is also difference among them. Mm-hmm. You know, what I know is that the whole year they are growing products. There is difference between families, and in this festivity also they talk, you know. They show the energy that they have and they fight.
Are you looking forward to seeing the fighting today? Or is there a sense of trepidation, a sense of nervousness about
that? I'm nervous. Police will use tear gas. Mm-hmm. I don't like to feel the tear gas. Mm-hmm. And I don't like to be in crowded places sometimes, you know. I arrived yesterday. And yesterday they were having a party as well. They were fighting. I meet a group at midnight, and they were drinking, singing, and suddenly they stopped the music. This was yesterday, midnight, and suddenly one guy like this.
Remberto at this point makes a headbutting motion.
I was shocked. They didn't fight. They stopped. The police was there as well. But yeah, I'm nervous.
Do you think there is a danger of that happening to one of us today, that you could be randomly attacked, or no?
Probably. Most of these people, they don't like to be taking pictures by strangers, you know? Mm-hmm. And they are drunk. So mm-hmm. you need to be careful, of course, all the time. Some of them, they are drinking, they don't like pictures, and they will punch you. You know?
Is it more dangerous for us as gringos?
Probably, yes.
I bump into Mickey again, my new friend and ally from last night. He introduces me to a powerful-looking figure, a man who's definitely at the top of the food chain he's in. Mickey sort of forces us to take a photo together, and then he shakes his fist at me. It's a joke, I think.
Kilmes?
Yeah.
Strong.
Yeah, I'm gonna be here. I think I might be here as well.
Remberto, meanwhile, has a friend with him, named Max, who also speaks English.
Yes, I'm a bit nervous, I'm a bit excited, I'm a bit like kind of like getting this energy, you know. There will be a point in which some people go crazy, and they will like try to fight anybody who's around. I'll be around, so if they like try to fight me, well, I'll have to fight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's why I'm a bit nervous, but I'll be also happy like to, whether I bleed or the other person bleeds. Yeah, anyway, everything's gonna go for Pachamama, so it'll be for the good, not for me, for the other person, but for everybody.
Mm-hmm. So, you are willing to fight today?
I am. I don't want to. Too sincere, man. Yeah, I don't want to look like a very cocky young man. I'm gonna come here and fight some and kill some people, you know? You know, to be told, I'm here more like to document and learn this. But if I have to fight, well, I have to fight.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm here.
This is it. 10:30 is what they said.
There are said to be around 60 tribes coming into the town today, and they're still arriving. The scene is pretty dramatic. You can spot these hordes of people suddenly appear through the dust on a side street as they run down the hill towards the square.
The enemy.
Like, is something seriously scary about that?
This is petrifying. It's like a scene out of Football Factory, Bolivian style. Like,
that is terrifying.
Then they arrive in the square. They dance for a little bit, and then they continue to move around the square, or else they just disappear off into one of the streets. The rival tribes do come close to one another, but they're respecting each other's personal space. For now. Because there simply will not be enough room for everyone very soon. You can hear that ringing that's coming from small bells. They're in cotton balls attached to the costumes of the men. They also wear these wide leather belts to protect the midriff, and they've got bright native weavings which run diagonally across the chest. On their head they wear these sort of conquistador helmets, which have large painted feathers attached to them, pointing upwards. The women are wearing long bright coloured skirts, and they've got these huge sun hats with plenty of ribbons and feathers on them. A lot of people wear walking sandals called abarcas. There are, though, some people who are dancing and playing music who are wearing non-traditional dress.
Is it Celtic jersey?
Yeah.
Who's there?
He's probably going to be the hardest one of them all.
Yeah. Good to see Magnus being represented on the world stage.
We're huddled in the porch of a restaurant, watching each tribe enter the square. It suddenly becomes apparent that there is a massive police presence here, which is both reassuring and sort of concerning. You start to get that feeling like when you're playing Jenga. Like, how far can we go until this whole thing collapses into madness? Surely there's only so many tribes that can march into the square before we start to see fighting break out. There's a tangle of tribes in front of us, and some of the men have whips. They're supposed to be used on their own people to get them into shape to move and to dance. But there's a man clearly using his whip as a weapon here, and there's an altercation.
Get back.
A couple of men begin to throw punches, but they're pulled away from one another. It's like there's an unwritten rule that this preamble is supposed to last as long as possible. It's a weird thing to say, but I just want the all-out brawls to happen now. Pull the plaster off, let me stop imagining having my head kicked in, and just let it happen for real. The peacemakers are fighting a losing battle anyway. To our right, on another corner of the square, you can just about make out some pandemonium. Limbs are flying, and it looks like the first all-out brawl of the day. I go off and I get a closer look, but as soon as I get there, this cloud of white gas starts billowing towards me.
Tear gas is out.
You can taste the tear gas.
Oh my god, I can actually feel it.
Oh, that is horrible.
Go,
guys.
Go. Oh. Oh, fuck.
To get to me, no. Oh, Jesus.
Keep on.
I've run away to a side street and then up a hill to get to the outskirts of the town. It's hard to know where everyone is, but the tear gas has split us up and we've all sort of gone in different directions across town.
You okay?
Yeah.
I get my breath back and try to walk around the town to get back to the square without walking into the tear gas again. I stumble upon two of our group, Connor and Charlie. They're having a pretty good time, actually. They're getting a dance lesson off some guy outside his house.
Come on!
I get back down to the square where it seems to be relatively safe again, but the place has become completely scattered. I know that there's due to be some organisation to the fighting, but that's just not happened so far. and as soon as everyone rushes back into the square, random, all-out fighting begins to resume, and it's met with the exact same response.
Yes, yes, yes!
Fucking hell again!
It's clear now that there's just no point being anywhere near the main square. Police are firing tear gas non-stop, and all of the action has now moved to these narrow side streets. I run down one of these streets and see an entire tribe run in my direction. So I pull in and wait inside a doorframe and hang there until they've all gone past. I pop back out and I continue down the street. And that's when it happens. There is an old man about 10 feet away from me, and I make eye contact with him, and he runs towards me, and he throws a right hook, and I just dodge it. I turn around to face him, and he's going for it again. I jump back to evade it, and I start to run away, and he sweeps his leg to trip me, but somehow that also misses. Some other locals have seen me and start chanting, "Gringo, gringo, gringo." But I continue to run, and I keep on running. I'm not sure if I'll ever forget that split second where I made eye contact with that man, as he was pulling back his hand and turning it into a fist. He was tiny and looked about 70. I'm not quite sure when he lost his two front teeth, but there was this sort of dryish film of blood setting on his lower lip. He was completely pissed, and it looked like he'd been fighting already. But when he saw me, obviously he wanted some gringo blood. My mentality, though, was flight or flight. I was not hanging around for that. I find the rest of our group.
Yeah, I don't think the guy who was trying to punch me wanted to hug me after. I think he wanted to kill me.
The old men in Matcha are now completely polluted, and they are single-handedly the greatest danger to us in this town. For every enraged veteran of Matcha that wants to kill us, there's also a person who just wants to dance.
Everybody's on medals.
Legend, really nice guy. All the nice people are really starting to come out now.
Relative calmness has finally developed. The fighting is now in a controlled state. A big circle has formed under the church tower. Police are allowing two people of similar size into the middle of this ring. The police then proceed to referee the fight. It's bare-knuckle fighting, but no weapons are allowed. Once someone gets knocked to the ground, the fight is over. Or if someone spills blood. Young men, old men, and a handful of women offer themselves to enter the ring. They throw punches until they wear themselves out, and the sober fights are pretty ferocious. The drunken competitors lack a certain artistry, and often have to be pulled back by the police when they want to keep battering their opponent after it's all over. A man wanders into the ring, who I recognise. His name is Andrew, and he's one of the Scottish guys who's travelled here with us.
Oh my god, he's not.
Andrew from Scotland, representing the Gringos. He's in there. There's no one else around him.
He's actually going for this, voluntarily. He is about to fight a shorter, chubbier man. But when the police see that a gringo has entered the ring, they quickly change that guy out for a taller, more muscular man.
No! Oh fuck!
They shake one another's hands, and those locals are cheering because the gringo has been knocked to the ground. A right-left combo to the mouth floors Andrew and he walks away, bloodied, but smiling from ear to ear. His reaction?
That was fantastic.
It was fantastic.
I grabbed a couple of minutes with our fallen soldier a little later for a more considered chat.
I don't know if they were wanting me to get knocked out, but they were certainly not against me getting in the ring.
Yeah.
Everyone was like, oh, yeah, yeah, go for it. Yeah, get in. Oh, let's fight. Yeah, let's do that. I was doing the same as the locals, you know, drinking a wee bit. And then all of a sudden, something clicked to me. I was just like, oh, you know what, may as well go and get involved. As the day went on, and we went walking around the side streets, and we were getting pushed and shoved and sort of riled up. Like, lots of Oblivion boys came and were saying, oh, yeah. I mean, I think I had 3 fights planned if I didn't get in this one, something like that. I was a wee bit scared at the start, a wee bit prohibited by some of the violent action they were having, and the whips especially. I didn't want to get whipped.
Yeah.
I'd rather get punched than whipped. Look, he got 2 on me, but I got 1 on him, so I'd say that's a fair fight. But afterwards, I got a few photos of a few of the random Bolivian men that were there and some other people that were there. And then I kind of went on a wander by myself. I was chatting to this, like, sort of middle-aged man, and he was asking me, he was like, ah, you fought just then, you pelear just then? I was like, yeah, yeah. And then out of the blue, this grandpa comes up, and he's just, like, staring. He's just standing right there looking at the both of us as we're talking, and all of a sudden he goes bang,
jeez,
and he just punches me. And yes. then the old man, the middle-aged man, kind of drags him away. Oh yeah, he got my jaw,
right.
I didn't really feel it. I mean, I did feel it, but I didn't really recognize. I was just kind of like, oh, why'd you do that, like, sort of thing.
Andrew would go on to become a viral sensation with thousands and thousands of views on Bolivian media platforms of this absolutely amazing photo. In the photo, Andrew has his arse on the ground and his opponent's arm is still cocked from the knockdown blow. According to some locals, Andrew is the first ever gringo to volunteer to fight at the festival. And so, while I was happy enough to run away from my potential fight, I'm also kind of satisfied that someone from our group is less of a coward than I am. It feels like we might just have earned a little bit of respect in this town. And when we walk past a little shed that's having a party after sundown, we decide it would be rude to not see what's going on. The dearth of drunk granddads means we're generally safe here, and we're having civil conversations with people who don't look like they want to headbutt us. Now, the fighting is still going on outside, and the police are now gone. So this shed is full of joy and wholesome connections between people who grew up 10,000 kilometers away from one another. And then outside the shed, on the streets, there are all-out street brawls. We've got no policemen there to stop the fight when someone is on the ground. And we get the hell out of there and back to our hotel. We are told in no uncertain terms that the karaoke room is not open for us. The morning after, and the celebrations have moved here to Pukwata. Although celebrations feels like the wrong word.
I'm just lying out on the footpath. Fucking hell. Liverpool jersey on.
Imagine a 10-day music festival. This is what the campsite would look like and smell like on day 10. The ground is wet, the dirt has turned to mud, and there hasn't been any rain.
Time for a fight.
The old men have done another rollover, it seems, and the police haven't shown up. The whole thing is about to enter a whole new level of grimness. I don't always make good decisions, but this might just be one of them. I find a minibus going in the direction of La Paz and politely ask the driver to get me the hell out of this town. I've survived with every bone in my body intact, and it's time to walk away from the table. It does strike me that I did come to this deeply ritualistic place and not make a sacrifice. None of my blood was spilt here in the name of Pachamama. Does this make me a bad person? Some sort of voyeur? Quite possibly. It also feels a little bit like a bad omen, as if Pachamama would somehow get her revenge on me.
caliente, vamos a matarnos. Niños de la calle. Oye, Osman.
¿Qué pasó, bro?
Esta vida callejera está bien jodida, hermano.
Earlier on, we briefly heard from Daniel, the La Paz tour guide. Daniel is also a hip-hop artist called Metafora.
Dedicada para los vatos que saben de calle. Cuando naces allá abajo todo es un desmadre. Son hermanos diferentes sangre. En la calle se condena todo aquel que falle.
That's my passion, you know, music is my passion. I've been doing this since 2006. I started doing this in London, actually. I lived there for 9 years. Right. And yeah, back then the rap scene is very big, but there wasn't any Latin rapper in the scene. So I have one of my cousins there in London, and then he was the one who put this thing on me, you know. He said, we can make rap, you know, we can be the Latin guys here, you know. And then, yeah, this is how I started writing music. What Bolivian people listen to is basically chicha. You know, yeah, chicha is a kind of, is our version of cumbia, you know, and chicha sounds like so that's why we call it chicha, you know. Yeah. So yeah, it's the most popular kind of music here, even though it's very related to the very low class, you know. But it's everybody has some of chicha music in their playlist, I guess. Yeah, every Bolivian. Yeah,
hip hop obviously has a huge place in this market. So when you're playing, for example, is everybody from all different communities of La Paz coming to see your shows? Is it a certain type of community, or who's listening to hip hop in Bolivia?
Yeah, well, hip hop is quite big here, especially among people in El Alto. You know, people in El Alto has a lot of things to say, and the best thing is hip hop for that. You know, you can express yourself, you can tell about your struggles, and yeah, I think that's why it's very well embraced in El Alto, especially. You know. And when these gigs come, you know, most of the supporters are from El Alto too.
It's time to explain El Alto here. And if you've just shown up to Bolivia with no information, you could be forgiven for thinking that El Alto is just the neighborhood of La Paz. This is very much not the case. La Paz and El Alto are officially neighboring cities. They are very much not the same thing.
For sure, yes. El Alto actually is the highest indigenous capital in the world and the biggest one. Actually, 80% of the population up there is indigenous.
At an average height of 4,150 meters above sea level, El Alto is the highest settlement in the world, with a population of over 100,000 people.
And they're very proud. You know, people up there in El Alto is very proud. Proud of their culture, their roots. So yeah, it's very different from La Paz, actually, and they like to be different, you know, because they asked to be separate from La Paz. They used to be a part of the city, but 38 years ago they decided to be a different one. Right. So now they are, they have their own government, their own budget, and actually El Alto is growing very big. It's mm-hmm. It's the second biggest city in the country after Santa Cruz.
And why did they want to break away? Is there like a very distinct feeling up there that they really see themselves as different to La Paz?
Yes, well, one of the reasons was that El Alto was considered as the poorest sectors of the city, you know, one of the poorest neighborhoods, so that's why it wasn't getting enough attention from the government. But now, since they have enough people to be a city, you know, they decided to just be separated. Now it has its own budget, as I said, so it can just grow and be themselves, you know. Yeah.
Una rola pa las almas que al cielo partieron. Su recuerdo vive eterno en la jungla y cemento. Nos rodeamos los cuidentes.
What are you saying in your music?
Well, they're talking about their life, you know, the struggle, basically, you know. In El Alto, it's quite tough to find a good job, and actually, even educated people, you know, is working like taxi drivers or working in the construction side, you know. So, yeah, of course, this the kind of frustrations as well, you know. People sometimes always go for a study, thinking that this will take you out from the hood, you know, take you away from all this life. But well, this in this society doesn't work like this, you know. So of course, if you study, then you get this frustration. So people talk about that, you know, the frustration, or maybe you don't get the chance to study, and of course, it's another frustration because then you think that only study will help you out, you know. So it's just rappers just talk about that. I'm basically talking about a life without a crime, you know. All my music is based in good messages for the youth, you know. I saw how crime can be, how dangerous it is, you know. It's always better to show that there is a light at the end instead of just talking the bad stuff too, you know. Mm-hmm. So yeah, this is what I'm trying to take and give with my music, you know. I just try to take and give peace through my music, you know.
El Alto is connected to the same metro system as La Paz, however, and by metro system I mean Mi Teleférico, a subway in the sky. This is a cable car system with 11 different lines. It's the only reasonable way to get between the two cities. Landing here via cable car means you float over the steep valley from La Paz, and your first sight of El Alto is from above. And we've clearly got acres and acres of street markets going on. But it's only really when you're on foot that you realise El Alto is just completely outlandish.
Yeah, it's weird, man. It's like
weird.
Fucking markets, just like loads of tourists.
It's like Blade Runner.
Yeah.
There's something doomsday about the place, but it also feels futuristic.
A night out in El Alto would be interesting, wouldn't it?
There are unpaved roads, some improvised structures.
Chocolates, chocolate con leche, té verde, mates, frappés, queques, dobles, mintas,
brownies, disfrute
con tus amigos en nuestro karaoke de la exactamente.
And then, boom, Optimus Prime's head is poking out of a building. And then, it turns out, there are several more of these types of buildings. These gleaming multi-stories with trippy facades. You see the face of Iron Man popping out of the top of one tower. Another high-rise resembles the Titanic. These buildings have been constructed by a new generation of extremely wealthy residents of El Alto. And the buildings are known as cholets.
Cholet is these crazy buildings that you will find only in El Alto, you know. And they can be so colorful, they can be so extravagant because they represent the Andean culture and they also represent the personality of the owner, you know. So they can be very crazy. And now we even have these fantasy cholets. And there you can see like Transformers cholets, like Iron Man cholets, you know. So yeah, it's also, you can see a lot of influence of this J-pop, especially because of the manga and the anime, you know.
Okay.
So yeah, at the beginning, these buildings started like showing the very Andean culture, but now they're taking different branches, and now there is this fantasy cholets, quite crazy too, yeah.
Okay, very interesting. So this is sort of a way of like a, rather than buying a Ferrari, or maybe they have Ferraris as well, I don't know.
Well, they have, I mean, these cholets can be very expensive. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if they have a Ferrari, yeah, to be honest, you know, yes. And they can be like even more than $1 million US dollars, these cholets, you know. And people up there, they managed to build this because they are very business people.
Okay.
So they have, they made a system, you know, they made a system to make money and build these expensive buildings. So they make sure that they have different business in each floor.
Okay.
And they will build the first one. Then once business are making money there, then they will go to the next one. And a different business, maybe a party venue, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, so once the party venue is making money, they go to the next step, which can be an indoor sport, you know, like little football or maybe a swimming pool. And then they go just like this, you know. They just build the cholets one floor after another. And then at the end, they build their little house to stay up there to see all their hard work from up there, you know. So they are amazing. They are amazing. If you see them, then it's hard to believe how they managed to build this, these mansions, you know, they are like huge and amazing.
Have you been to a party in a chalet?
Yes, for sure. Yes, it's a big experience. You know, it's a big experience. I think every Bolivian must have this experience at least once in a lifetime, you know. It's nice. It's a whole protocol. It's nothing that you go just there and drink and dance, you know. That you need to follow a proper protocol to get welcome to the party and to be welcomed by the host, you know. So yeah, it's very important in our culture, you know. Mm. Party is always important in our culture, so that's why we have these crazy chalets. Yeah,
I presume tourists aren't allowed into the parties.
Yes, of course. I mean, we like to show this to people, and if they are, if you come with me, even though you don't have an invitation, then for sure you will be very welcome. You know, they will say, "What is this gringuito doing here?" You know, yes, and then everybody will want to have a shot with you. You know, yes.
Yeah. One of Daniel's music videos is filmed in a cholet.
This shit is trash, cause you don't find nobody to be trust. Nobody worth the pain, nobody worth the cry.
Nope. Making a video in a cholet was always a dream, you know. Yeah, and finally I could make it in this last video. And it's very well embraced by people as well, you know, because I have two nice models wearing this traditional outfit, you know. So yeah, it's just beautiful, you know. It's just trying to show the indigenous side of Bolivia to other places, you know. I guess that's also my goal, to show my culture.
Cholet is a combination of the words cholo and chalet. Cholo refers to people with some degree of indigenous blood. A huge percentage of the population here are of Aymara heritage. Cholita, then, is a phrase used to refer to Aymara women. They wear bowler hats and large, colourful layered skirts and shawls. The term cholita might have traditionally been pejorative, but now it's been reclaimed by the women. And one of the ways the cholitas have gone about doing this is by fighting. I'm in a cholet with the words Havana emblazoned in block capitals on the outside. The cholet is made up of green glass and green panels, and the patterns are jagged. If you stand back and squint, the whole building looks like a uniformed man with a hat on. You walk inside and the interior is like a 1970s casino meets the Grand Budapest Hotel.
We sell beers. Only beers.
Oh, okay.
There you go.
In a big hall with a large balcony overlooking it, there is a ring for wrestling. This is the cholita we are rooting for today. She wears a blue dress and a black hat. Her name is Maria. That is Maria's younger brother on the mic, by the way. And he's introduced Maria's opponent, sporting a green and gold dress. And unfortunately for this cholita, she's up against a titan, the goat of cholita fighting, Maria. Maria picks up her opponent and performs a body slam. She performs a choke slam, a power slam, a fireman's carry slam, a gorilla press slam, a sidewalk slam, a grand slam. But what we witness next sickens me to my core. Maria tries to perform a pin to end a fight, but the referee intervenes and stops her by kicking her. This ref, this portly middle-aged man, then headbutts her. And then he throws her out of the ring. One wonders, just how deep does the corruption in Bolivian cholita wrestling officiating actually go? But Maria, this modern superwoman, overcomes the deep state conspiracy to derail her combat sports career. She re-enters the ring by climbing on the turnbuckle. She jumps on top of the referee. And good overcomes evil, right here in this El Alto Cholette. Maria then pulls off a Gary Neville, a Tom Brady, and she transitions to the microphone to commentate on the next fight.
Yeah, Cholita's wrestling, talking about the show, is I can say that the wrestling was always a thing for us. You know, I remember growing up as a Bolivian child, I had Mexican wrestling every weekend, you know, there was these shows. But I left the country to England, and during my time there, the show was getting big here, you know. Right. So I've never get to see a Cholita wrestling when I was young, you know. So when I came back to the country and I hear about the show, I was like, is this a joke?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, even me being Bolivian, you know, was like kind of strange. I was like, how comes ladies wrestling each other, you know, wearing the traditional outfit? And when I start working in the tourism area, then of course they told me that I had to take people there, and I was like, no way, you know, no way. But my first time there in the show was a good surprise, you know. Yeah, I was surprised, because it's good fun. If you enjoy this WWE action, you know, you will love the show.
Yeah.
But the important thing about this show, I guess, is that these ladies is trying to show other ladies that they can do anything. You know, sometimes even wrestling, you know. And you need to know that the Cholitas, they are important in our society.
Yeah.
These ladies do everything, you know. They even climb up mountains, and they do it with these puffy skirts, you know. The climbing Cholitas, they are like heroes for us, you know. The Cholitas wrestling, they are part of the fighting against domestic violence. You know, domestic violence is a big problem here in Bolivia. So yeah, with this, they are trying to empower ladies, you know, to empower women to let them know that they don't need to suffer any abuse, you know. If they are with someone that is abusing just because they are he is providing, then of course you can provide yourself too, you know, and you can do it by yourself. So I think that's the most important part of this encounter, you know, this fighting, of this battling, is just sharing energy and showing others that they can also do that.
Sadly, the Cholitas require a fee if I want to sit down to record a conversation with them. But I am a broke backpacker. There'll be no interview then. I'll tell the children. The Yungas Road is a pretty infamous cycle route. From a height of 4,800 metres, it snakes down to around 1,200 metres along a 60-kilometre path. In some ways, it's an easy cycle, because it pretty much only involves freewheeling downhill. And in other ways, it's not so easy. Especially when the mind wanders and you think what might happen if, say, you miss a hairpin bend. A fall of about 2,000 feet off these cliffs is what would happen. At its narrowest, the road is only 3 meters wide, which is just about enough breathing room for a terrible mountain biker like myself. The road is carved into the mountain, and there are no barriers to stop you going over the edge. This was once the only road that could take you from La Paz down to the jungle town of Coroico on the other side of the Cordillera Real mountain range. Buses full of passengers and trucks full of produce would go up and down every day. And if you want to give yourself a hefty dose of anxiety today, you can go onto YouTube and look at the footage of when this road was open to such vehicles. Carlos Pizzaroso Inde is a name that may be mentioned by local tour guides here. He was the driver of a lorry that had 100 locals crammed into the back of his truck when he made a journey in 1983. He drove over the edge and there were no survivors. By the mid-90s, there were 200 to 300 people dying on this road per year. It's why the youngest road was considered to be the most dangerous road in the world, and why it's now more commonly known as Death Road. A bus transports us up to the top of the mountain via a newer, less deathly, two-laned national road. It's cold, but the skies are clear. We cycle along the tarmac for half an hour before we pull in and divert our journey into the much smaller, much less tarmac-y road that tightly coils around the mountain. The fog descends and some showers commence. Visibility is apparently always poor. It's somewhere along this point that drivers might spill a bit of alcohol out their window or onto their front tyres. A tribute to Pachamama. Protection for the journey ahead. I follow the rest of the bikes and hold on to my brakes. There are small crosses along the road. Tiny shrines to those who've lost their lives. We cycle under a waterfall. We get off at one juncture to carry our bikes over a landslide. And the temperature starts to rise, and the sun comes back. The layers of clothing gradually come off, and after a couple of hours of deep focus, our guide congratulates us and tells us that we have completed Death Road. Everybody is intact. The remainder of the journey down towards our destination takes place along much drier roads, roads that are a touch wider, with grass on the outside. My hands are sore from braking on the main descent, but now they're recovering. Finally, a safe time to test out the speed of this bike. It's properly sunny now. The dirt roads are totally dried out. I pick up the speed. This is amazing. I've hit a rock, or a pothole, or something that I didn't see. I've got no idea. All I know is that I'm flying over the handlebars, I career towards the road, and I land, face first. I drag myself to sit up. I'm in a pool of my own blood. It feels like an eternity, but eventually the next biker comes along. It's Liam from Carlisle.
Yeah, we took a corner, and as we got round the corner, I'm just there, obviously still held on. And then I just see a bike kind of in front of me, but there wasn't anyone on the bike. It was just literally laying on the floor. So instantly I've hit the brakes. I'm like, literally, where's Owen gone? He basically came off the bike. He obviously hit a rock. Must have went about maybe 2 meters ahead. It's like it literally underneath, like a tree on the edge of the cliff. I froze instantly. I was thinking, I don't know what to do in this situation. It's just covered in blood, literally laying on the edge.
Our guide comes along and he breaks the two pieces of bad news. First, that my nose looks absolutely shattered. And second, that our bus is not allowed to drive along these narrow roads. So I need to get back on my bike and cycle to the next village before I can be picked up and brought to hospital. I leave a trail of blood on my way to the next village and I'm put into the back of a bus. We drive towards La Paz. It's a long journey made longer by the fact that it's still festival season, or maybe just a regular Friday. Small towns are hard to get through because of street dancing and parades. Or maybe I'm just drifting off and hallucinating. And maybe this bus isn't really surrounded by cholitas in orange dresses right now. We needn't have been in any rush. I get to hospital. A doctor tells me I have broken my nose and have a crushed nasal cavity. Through various levels of international administration involving a language barrier, it will be 5 full days before the hospital can perform the required surgery. And then a further 2.5 weeks before a consultant gives me the green light to finally get back on my feet and leave La Paz. In those 5 days before my surgery, I keep picturing that elderly man back in Macha at the fighting festival. The heavily inebriated man with the dry film of blood on his upper lip. The man who wanted to beat me up. And I sit here in this hospital bed with blood constantly gathering on my upper lip, with my face in tatters and questions about how permanent the damage is going to end up being. And for a brief moment, I wonder what might have happened if I allowed myself to get punched by that man. If I instead allowed a little of my blood to be spilled in that weird little town, would I then have satisfied Pachamama? Would Pachamama then have neglected to come after me on the highway of death? It turns out I have messed with an Andean goddess. I will never mess with an Andean goddess again. This has been episode 3 of Diverted, a 10-part original series for Off the Ball produced by me, Owen Shahan. If you click follow or subscribe or give it 5 stars or send me a fax message telling me you mildly enjoyed it, you will substantially improve my day. And there's a lot more to come in this series. My handle across social media platforms is Owen Shahan, as all one word, and there is video content across those platforms to accompany this podcast. All of that information is in the show notes. In the next episode of Diverted, we will travel to Uruguay, where we will visit the home of one of the survivors of the 1972 plane crash, where a team of rugby players were stranded up the Andes and had to resort to eating their deceased teammates in order to survive. Also, part 4 of my Patagonia hitchhiking journey, where I may or may not find myself in an even bigger pickle than before. Chat to you then. Thanks for listening.